Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Water, fire, food, education, those are some basic themes of today's Access Utah. We're broadcasting live from the plaza outside the Federal Building in downtown Salt Lake City at the Utah celebration of the 150th anniversary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We'll talk about the effects of a nearly non-existent snowpack. Randy Julander, snow survey manager with the Natural Resources Conservation Service, also forecast the fire season with Forest Service spokesperson Kathy Jo Pollock. And we'll talk rural development and agriculture with Dave Conine, State Director of Rural Development with the USDA, and Mark Gibbons, Lewiston farmer and president of Utah Dairymen's Association. Later in the hour, we'll commemorate the coinciding 150th anniversary of the Morrill Act, which established the People's Universities, a land-grant system of public colleges and universities, which helped make higher education more accessible to all. Talk with Chuck Gay, USU Associate Vice President for Cooperative Extension. This program is supported by Utah State University Extension. We're happy to be here in Salt Lake City celebrating USDA's 150th anniversary. And we begin with a conversation that I recorded on Friday with Randy Julander, who is the snow survey manager with the Natural Resources Conservation Service. We had to talk with him on Friday because he and many other snow survey managers are in Alaska for a big conference as we speak. Here's that interview from Friday.
This part of the program, we check in with the Snowpack. That's a service provided by the Natural Resources Conservation Service, part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Randy Julander is snow survey manager in, Mr. Julander, in the Utah area, Intermountain West?
You bet. I run all of Utah, Nevada, and the Sierras of California.
And so we want to check in. We've been hearing that snowpack is very low, a lot lower than it was last year. And I wonder, first of all, if you could maybe give some specific examples. I saw some pictures you sent out of last year versus this year. It's a stark difference.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, right now, snowpacks in Utah range from zero, which is comprised actually the majority of the state, all of the southern area, the southeast area, Monticello, Moab, all of the Dirty Devil, all of the Price, San Rafael, all of these areas are already melted out, including the northern Uintas. In fact, the only place we really have any snow is the very upper elevations of the Sevier, the Beaver, the Bear, the Weber, and Duchesne and Provo. And when I say the upper elevations, we're talking 9,000 feet and higher. Basically anything below that elevation is already melted out. We were eating lunch in Camas on Thursday after having done some work. We're actually able to get out in the field and do summer work right now. And we talked to the folks who had just plowed the road over the top of Mirror Lake Highway. And it's not officially open, but it will be officially soon. People can drive over it even now.
So zero snowpack in many of these areas. What would the situation be on a more normal, average year?
Well, in an average year, we would just now be ramping up with stream flow. In fact, snowmelt would just barely be really hitting its full stride. We'd have another 4 weeks of snowmelt, and in fact, peak flows on our rivers and streams wouldn't be coming until basically now through the next 4 weeks. And so last year, we had just barely hit our peak snowpacks at this time, and it just barely started melting snow. And snowmelt went on clear through the end of July. And so we have the two extremes. Last year was, of course, an extreme on the very high end, and this year we have an extreme on the very low end. A lot of people ask, is it the worst year ever? And the answer to that is unequivocally no, it's not. But it's certainly not one that we like to see.
And probably it seems worse because we had such a wet year last year.
Oh, absolutely. When you put the two back-to-back, the contrast is very stark. And that's another question a lot of people like to ask is, have we ever seen back-to-back years like this? And the answer to that is yes, it does happen, and it happens both ways, low to high and high to low, 31, 32, 52, and 53, 97, 98, 2004, 2005 examples that come to mind.
Hmm. Do we get any benefit, carryover benefit from a especially wet year last year?
Oh, absolutely. Last year, when we take a look at the stream flow actually remained high, not only through the runoff season, April, May, June, July, it remained high into August, and all the way through February and March of this particular year. And so we got great benefits out of it, and one of the biggest is that our reservoir storage, that carryover that we kept from last year, made sure that the majority of reservoirs this year were full without any appreciable runoff.
What are some of the effects, and maybe some of the effects we wouldn't think of? Are we going to have to go on rationing with watering our lawns? Has it got to that part? Is it going to affect agriculture? What are some of the effects?
This particular year, since we have full reservoir storage, most people are not going to notice a huge difference. Those people who do not have reservoir storage, in other words, farmers and ranchers out in rural Utah that depend on that direct stream flow, are already going to be hurting because stream flow is dropping off very quickly. In fact, in a lot of cases in southeastern Utah, and it's starting to spread through the rest of the state, the flows are down in the, well, below the 25th percentile, which is extremely low for this period of time. And so agriculture, of course, is going to be the first to take the brunt. And most people, municipalities and things like that, will be just fine this year because of, number one, outstanding reservoir storage, and number two, really good water management that's being done throughout the state.
But agriculture will take a hit because of the low stream flow.
Yes. That's for any of those farms and ranches that are on direct stream flow that don't have reservoir storage, they'll be hurting this year.
It does seem like a whiplash effect. We were worried about flooding last year.
Yes, indeed. And not only that, flooding of long duration, which is fairly rare here in the state of Utah. Normally, when we talk about floods here in the state of Utah, you're talking about a week, maybe 2 weeks in duration. Last year, the flood potential went from May all the way through mid-July, which is very extraordinary.
Mm. And fire danger, we've been hearing, we're going to be talking about fire danger a little later in this program. Does this low snowpack, et cetera, does that affect fire?
Oh, absolutely. In this particular case, what we're essentially doing is making summer at least a month and potentially 6 weeks longer on the front end. We don't have any idea what it's going to play on the back end, you know, into September, October, but it could easily go longer. The longer your fire season is, the more potential that you have for very large kinds of fires. One of the things that we're seeing is because of last year, we had this huge wet year. We produced a phenomenal amount of vegetation, particularly in the fine fuels area, the grasses, forbs, brush, and things like that. And this year's snowpack was so meager, it really didn't push down all those grasses. Normally, you get a big snowpack, and it flattens all of the grasses and things like that, mashes it down onto the ground. Most of that, a majority of it from what we've seen across the state, is still standing. And when you put very, very dry conditions on fine fuels that are elevated above the ground, you have at least the potential for having these fine fuels ignite from various kinds of sources. You know, people are careless in their campfires, or they're smoking, or lightning, or all kinds of ignition sources. When that happens, and it happens over a longer period of time, then certainly you have the potential for a longer fire season. And one of the things that we're seeing is we also monitor not only snowpack precipitation temperature, but we monitor soil moisture as well. And that the upper layers of our soils are drying out extremely fast. At the lower elevations, in some of the range conditions, we're seeing a lack of soil moisture to the extent that plant life, in other words, grasses that have already come up, will be dying back very soon. In other words, the green grass that we normally see in the spring is already turning brown from summer kinds of heat and lack of moisture.
And as you mentioned, people be up in these areas sooner, probably, more accessible.
Oh, yes, absolutely. In fact, many of the roads have been open and accessible for several weeks, and people are getting out there and starting to recreate. And like I said, I'm sure the Mirror Lake Highway will be open publicly very soon. That's very, very early access to the high country.
What about some of the other states that you monitor? Similar problems?
Very similar in California, very similar in Nevada. And in general, even in the states that I don't monitor, our program does, all of the western United States, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Wyoming, are all very likely in the same situation that we are.
Randy Juhlander is Snow Survey Manager with the Natural Resources Conservation Service. That's part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and it's the 150th anniversary celebration that occasions this program. You say you monitor not only the snowpack, but several other variables as well. Remind us what that is.
At each one of our snowtail sites here in the state of Utah, we monitor first and foremost how much water is in the snowpack. That is to say, if you melted the snowpack instantaneously, how much water would be standing there? We call that snow water equivalent. And that is critical in determining how much water is going to be coming down in any given year. And knowing how much water you have to work with allows people to manage that particular resource. The other thing we measure is snow depth. That's simply to say how much snowpack is standing at any given point. We measure the precipitation that falls. We measure the air temperature. We keep a very good track of that particular parameter. And then we also measure soil moisture and soil temperature at the surface level, 2 inches, at 8 inches down, and at 20 inches further down in there, which gives us a good idea of the hydrologic response of a given watershed. Very wet soils tend to produce high amounts of runoff, whereas very dry soils allow more of that snowpack to be absorbed by the snow, and it creates less runoff. That's a condition that we've seen this year. Low snowpack and very dry soils equates to very little runoff.
It all starts with water, doesn't it? This affects the wildlife, affects the economy, it affects everything. I imagine, especially this time of year, you're getting a lot of calls.
Oh, absolutely, and you're absolutely right. In the western United States, water does mean life. It means life to plants, it means life to wildlife, all of our animals, and it means sustainability in our communities. And so any kind of development that goes on is all water-dependent out here. In fact, every one of the communities in the state of Utah, with the exception of very few mining towns like Magna and places like that, were basically built on two things. The first thing is they had to have water, and the second thing is that when Brigham Young started this whole business, the next community could be no more than a wagon ride from the previous community. But they were all basically located based on that one primary commodity, and that's water.
And finally, where do we fit in with the long-term trends? I don't know how far records go back on the water situation.
We have been measuring snowpack across the state of Utah since the mid-1920s when George D. Clyde was head of the Bureau of Agricultural Engineering at Utah State University. So we have a very long, very, very long record of snowpack. And right now, the latest 30-year average that we have is about 3% below what the period of record average is. So we've just come through a couple of fairly dry decades, and we've had a couple of wet periods toward the end of these, and now it looks like we're having a dry one. Welcome to Utah. If you don't like the weather, stick around for 5 minutes. It'll change.
That's certainly true. Thank you very much, Randy Juhlander, Snow Survey Manager for several states in the West with the Natural Resources Conservation Service, part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Randy Juhlander, thanks so much.
I appreciate it.
Thanks for being with us for Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and as you can hear, the celebration is just about to get underway. It's the 150th anniversary today, in fact, of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And many agencies will be participating. We'll be talking with the Utah Director of Rural Development, Dave Conine, also with Mark Gibbons, a Lewiston farmer and president of Utah Dairymen's Association. That'll be coming up in the next segment. And we'll finish the program commemorating a coinciding 150th anniversary of the Morrill Act, which established the land-grant system of public colleges and universities, helped make higher education more accessible to all. We'll be talking with Chuck Gay, USU Associate Vice President for Cooperative Extension. By the way, this program is supported by Utah State University Extension. We go from the snowpack and water to fire danger and other related issues. We bring in Kathy Jo Bullock, who's with Public Affairs with the Forest Service. Thanks for joining us. So we talked a little bit with Randy Tulander about how the low snowpack, he says many of the areas is just non-existent snowpack this year, and how a dry year will affect fire potential. And I've been hearing that this stacks up to potentially be a very bad fire year.
Yeah, it possibly could be. It depends on what kind of moisture we get in late spring and early summer. If we get a lot of thunderstorms with some precipitation, it could be a normal season. But if we don't get the precipitation and we get a lot of dry lightning, things will dry out quickly. So we could have an early fire season, and it could last longer.
And with Ron Julander, with the lessening of snowpack, people are out and about earlier. That's a potential increase in fire danger.
Correct. And we've got a lot of people out because the lower lands have opened up. A lot of the roads are fairly dry. So we do have a lot of people out recreating in the forest at this point.
So last year, a wet year, increased fuels, I imagine. That adds to potential.
The fine fuels, yes. The grasses, we do have an abundance of them. Last year, we had a really wet season all the way through, so they stayed green. So this year, with less precipitation, they will dry out a lot sooner.
Mm-hmm. How will this affect prescribed burns?
We have looked at prescribed burning. We like to do that in the early spring and in fall. So a lot of agencies did get prescribed burning done this spring on the forest here. It got fairly warm fairly quick, and it greened up, so we were not able to pull those off this year. So.
Mm-hmm. Where to go to get information if I want to go up in the mountains? I'm worried about prescribed burns or fire issues. There's a place I can go to get information.
Individuals can call the local office, the BLM office, or the Forest Service offices, or you can call our office here in Salt Lake, and that's 801-236-3400.
By the way, by percentage, is it lightning? Is it natural causes, or is it people out there not being careful about their fires?
We do have lightning-caused fires, but a majority of our fires are person-caused. So we do ask that the public be extremely careful, make sure their campfires are out, no fireworks whatsoever, keep your ATVs and vehicles on the designated roads and trails.
That's a problem? ATVs,
yeah, it can be. They can go across some dry grass, cross country, which they're not supposed to do on the national forest, and their catalytic converter and so forth can cause fires. So, yes.
I hadn't thought about that one. There are myriad ways. And if we live in the dry west here, it's a potential a problem. And we've been seeing some fires already.
Yeah, down south, they've had a few fires already. Their grasses and fine fuels dried out a lot sooner than ours have up here.
What would you remind people then in terms of when they're out in the backcountry?
Please just be careful. Like I said, keep your vehicles on the roads and trails. Make sure your campfires are out. And you might want to call ahead to make sure there are no fire restrictions in place in the area you're going to.
I'm interested in the people who fight those fires. Mm-hmm. And I believe as we speak, there's a wildfire academy going on.
Yeah, it's held over here. It's down in Ridgefield. And at the academy, they do have a week-long course for beginner firefighters. They teach fire behavior, fire weather. So there's a lot of courses going on, and that's done always about the second week or third week in May.
Who qualifies? Can somebody come off the street and become a land firefighter?
Most of these individuals work for a federal agency or a state agency or county. So some of them are individuals that may be what we call an AD. They can be hired through an agency, but they're not really attached to anyone. But most of them are agency, county, or
Yeah. These are brave people. This can be very dangerous work.
So this can be very dangerous work.
It can be very dangerous work, and firefighter safety and public safety is always number one.
I saw up on the website for UtahFireInfo.gov. It seems to be a good clearinghouse site. Several agencies, I think. Defensible space. There's a campaign about defensible space.
Right. We ask homeowners along the urban interface, and actually cabins out in the mountains, that they really need to make sure that they don't have trees overhanging their roof, make sure there's no needles, get rid of all the dead leaves, don't stack your firewood next to your house, and make sure there's definitely a green space. That way their house is at least defensible if we do have a wildfire in those areas.
Are there increasing problems? Seems like more and more people want to build closer and closer to nature.
Correct. And then as the more homes built up into the mountainous areas, the more those individuals have to make sure that they're doing defensible space.
Is there some sort of permitting? I'm guessing it's be hard or impossible to build a private home in a forest, but do you have jurisdiction over areas that adjoin?
They're not allowed to build homes on national forests. There are cabins, summer homes, that are in the national forest, and those are on a permit.
Mm-hmm. And those would be the people targeted with this defensible space.
Correct. That's part of their permit that they do have to maintain the defensible space.
Yeah. What about the campgrounds information? Are these opening up earlier this year?
We have a few that have opened earlier this year, but we do have to go in and make sure they're ready for the public. So we have to make sure that there are no hazardous trees, if they're leaning or have loose limbs. The bathroom facilities have to be open. Picnic areas all have to be cleaned out. So some are open now, but most of them will be open by next weekend for Memorial Day.
And again, a good clearinghouse place to go for information like that.
Again, that would you can type in any national forest thing on Google, and it will pull up that forest website, and they should have their campground or recreation information there.
By the way, as a public affairs person, do you gear up for an especially busy time for you when it's potentially a bad fire season?
Yeah, I am prepared to be able to go at any time along the frontier if we do break a fire.
And we hear you and see you, of course, a lot, Kathy Jo Pollack, public affairs person for the Forest Service. By the way, 150th anniversary, Forest
right.
Service, part of the USDA. This is a special occasion.
Yes, it is, and we're really happy to be involved with it.
Yeah, that's an interesting story, I think.
Yeah, it's a great story, and 150 years, I mean, that's a long time, and Forest Service has been around a little over 100 years. So
yeah, and you wouldn't think of the Forest Service being with agriculture.
Well, it's more multiple use. We have recreation. We do grazing permits. There's minerals, which partly is handled through the BLM, but we are part of the Department of Agriculture with our timber and so forth.
Very good. Kathy Jo Pollack with public affairs with the Forest Service. They're part of the USDA. It's the 150th anniversary today of the signing. President Lincoln signed the Department of Agriculture into being, and there's a celebration on the plaza at the Bennett Federal Building in downtown Salt Lake City. You can hear the setting up, and there's some Future Farmers of America just to my left. We're just right next to the street. You hear some street noise here. This broadcast is supported by Utah State University Extension. And to conclude the broadcast a little later on, we'll be talking with Chuck Gay, USU Associate Vice President for Cooperative Extension. That's a coinciding anniversary, 150 years of the Morrill Acts and the land-grant institutions taking higher education to all. Coming up next, following a brief break, we're going to be talking to Dave Conine with Rural Development, Mark Gibbons, who's president of Utah Dairymen's Association. That's coming right up.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour,
we'll soak up the sophisticated sounds of bygone eras, French chanson, Italian lounge music, and Brazilian bossa nova.
Jackie has a thing, even in the
I'm Dan Storper.
And I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join us for World Retro, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Friday night at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Thanks for staying with us for Access Utah. Tom Williams from the plaza outside the Bennett Federal Building in downtown Salt Lake City on the occasion of the 150th anniversary celebration, which will be ongoing. Several events today for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. 150 years ago today, President Lincoln signed the bill putting into effect the U.S. Department of Agriculture. There's a coinciding anniversary. We'll be talking about that coming up. That's the land grant colleges and universities, the Morrill Act, that also was signed 150 years ago. We bring in today a representative of our farmers and ranchers. Mark Gibbons is a dairy farmer in Lewiston and president of Utah Dairymen's Association. Thanks for joining us.
You bet.
So this this must be a big occasion for you, representing the farmers and ranchers of Utah.
It is. It's a real honor to represent these people, represent, I guess, USDA and the liaison that we've made over the years with trying to make agriculture sustainable and make it so that we can provide a good living for our children, you know, and raise good kids on the farm.
And we hope to be joined here shortly by Dave Conine with the Rural Development. That seems to be an issue. Any place rural seems to be a fight to keep the kids at home, and that means jobs. You got to have jobs.
Yeah, got to have jobs. It's a pretty fine line you have to walk with rural development, and especially with the dairy industry that I'm involved with. There are issues with people, cows. The dairy industry has progressed enough now that their dairies are becoming larger, more concentrated, and so there is more odor. There are more issues with taking care of cows and taking care of their all the things that go with cows, and it makes difficult sometimes, you know, to mix the two together with a lot of development and still try to keep in touch with the agriculture. There's less and less producers, you know, dairy producers, ag producers in general, than there have been ever in this country, and the general population, I think, is getting more distance from what happens to agriculture, where their food comes from, how it's produced, where it's produced.
I was looking at some interesting statistics back up what you were saying. This is from the USDA. This is nationwide. But in 1860, average acreage per farm, 199, and today 418. So the farm's getting bigger. And the labor force in agriculture, but then with a much smaller population, some 15 million workers in agriculture, most of the nation were farmers, now down to some 2 million,
yeah,
much larger population. So fewer and fewer families,
yeah,
and I guess big businesses as well.
We're fifth-generation dairy farmers. It goes back to my father when he moved to Lewiston, started the dairy farm with one borrowed cow. And we have over 600 cows now, and that we milk, plus another 600-700 head of young stock for replacements. And he started out with a farm that had about 80 acres on it, and now we farm over 1,200 acres. And we involve a lot of our family, and we still have to hire, you know, four other employees outside of our family that work there on the dairy and the farm. And it's a challenge to take care of that.
Is it mostly these days the smaller family-owned operations, or has it become more the big corporations?
A lot of that is regionalized. In the east, northeast, they're smaller family-sized operations, and in the west, they're, because of the availability of the feed and the climate, those kind of things, there are a lot larger dairies. There are dairies that between the culmination of how many cows one individual owns, he'll own up to 75,000 cows. And it's just a real change from what has been, you know, historically in the past. That makes it so that there are fewer people that actually are involved in the industry and understand what goes on there.
Are you losing farmable acreage so that more and more people spread out?
Yeah, there are some of that. There's a lot of interest in protecting rural Utah, rural acreage, and keeping it in ag production. And it's a challenge because in our case, you know, you work all your life, your value is in your ground, your value is in your animals, and then when it's time to retire, there's a lot of people that look at that and say, okay, there's my retirement right there, and they sell, and where's the highest price? In development.
So is that happening more and more?
I think it happens kind of on a steady basis. It's like I say, with jobs coming in, somebody needs places to live, and those homes are being built, those development, you know, that development is taking place, and it just keeps growing and growing, and we see a little bit more pressure even in our valley, at North End, where I live all the time.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like there, when I talk to farmers, there are pressures from all sides, but there must be an attraction, generation after generation, to that lifestyle.
Well, it's a great lifestyle. I've raised three sons on that dairy, and all three of them wish they could be there now. I have one son that works full-time with me, and the other two come back part-time and work a full-time job besides that because they love the connection with the ground, and they love being out on the farm. They love the cows. My father on that dairy raised five sons, and we're three of us are still there on that same dairy farming, and we always thought that we weren't in the business of dairy farming or in the business of ag production. We were in the business of raising a family.
Hmm. I'll ask you about a couple of political issues. Get the perspective of a farmer, dairyman. One is the so-called Ag Gag Bill. Some people who aren't in agriculture don't see the problem. This passed in the legislative session. Prohibits in some cases filming and taking audio tape on agricultural operations. From your perspective, was this needed?
We've kind of fought this battle about where we should get our food from, and we have worked for I think the ag community has worked for hundreds of years of making the food supply the safest, most affordable, the easiest to obtain of anywhere on the earth. You can go into any grocery store and feel safe about the product that you're buying. Maybe I didn't understand the question just right, but we have all these people that, we can buy our food from Mexico or we can buy our food from these other countries. That scares me. Because I think in this country we'll never voluntarily lose a war militarily. I think we can always be superior in a war. But once we depend on the world to feed us, we're done. And, you know, our connection with USDA, as far as the ag community, as far as dairy, our support from them has made it so that we can make a living and feed our families in our town, in our county, in our state, in our nation, and I think the United States feeds the world. And I think that's, you know, what more do I say?
Do you see a threat with some of the ag business going overseas then?
I do. I've watched, for instance, in Afghanistan, I've seen some of those companies over there be contracted out to buy milk for the troops, and they'll just bring some powder in somewhere like Bahrain, mix water in with it, and that's what the troops are served. That would be the easiest target for terrorism, you know, to taint the food supply, and you know, it could cause all kinds of chaos. And so I guess I just don't trust what happens overseas. I know that their standards of quality, their standards of cleanliness, those kind of things are not as high as they are in the United States in a lot of places. And so, being an ag producer, I think we put out the best product in the world. Let me rephrase that. The question I was asking earlier, this law that was just passed in Utah. I couldn't hear you. I'm sorry. Yeah, we have a lot of traffic here. We are live on location. You can definitely tell that. That prohibits the filming of activists coming in and filming agricultural operations. The opponents of the bill said that this is just prohibiting activists coming in and making sure that the animals are safe. Of course, I'm guessing that producers like yourself say, well, there aren't that many problems.
Well, they've done a lot of this in the past, and what they'll do is they'll get someone to come in and put a hidden camera, or, you know, put it inside their clothing and film what's going on. And they have to go, I think, few and far between to find something really sensational. Now, as an agriculture producer, and especially with animals, if I don't take care of the animals on my farm, they don't produce. And that's my living. And so our animals on our dairy farm have better medical attention than my family ever did. We have veterinarians come in weekly and take care of those things, check for any problems. In the barn where they're milked, the standards for cleanliness are very, very high. They're checked every 3 times a day as they're milked, and those cows come in and they're checked if they have any problems with their feet or anything else, or their mobility. Those kind of things are monitored very closely. The maternity with those cows, we have monitors in there taking care of that. People need to understand that on our dairies and on our workplaces, that's how we make a living. And so it's our benefit to take care of those animals and make them as comfortable as we possibly can, make them as profitable as we possibly can.
What are your top concerns? What keeps you up at night?
EPA.
EPA?
I do. We have a lot. You know, there's two real challenges, especially for the dairy industry. The Environmental Protection Agency has got a lot of mandates that they come out with that are really kind of baseless. They'll come out and they'll say, well, if you're going to have any water leave your facility, you know, it becomes a water of the federal or waters of the federal government or waters of the state. And it could potentially, you know, carry some runoff with it. Well, a lot of those waters go to the neighbor or to the next farm, and that's what they use to irrigate their ground. And it's been that way for hundreds of years. We monitor what comes off of our dairy. We take soil samples. We take water samples. And we're very, very careful about where we fertilize and how we fertilize, because it goes back to the productivity issue. It's better for us if we take care of that. If EPA comes out and says, well, we are going to monitor everything that happens on this dairy and makes those windows so tight that we can't get there, we're out of business. The other big issue that we have is labor. And, you know, wherever you stand on immigration, this is what feeds the country is our labor force. And we have to have these people come in. We do everything we can to make sure that the people we hire are legal. We're, by law, prohibited to ask them if they're legal. But if they don't have the right numbers, they come in, they give us documentation, it's got, you know, the right things on it, and we're prohibited to ask them if this is correct documentation, if this is their, you know, true Social Security number. And then if we get a no-match letter, which is these numbers don't match, you know, the Social Security numbers, or they don't match anything, or someone else's Social Security number, then we know that documentation is false, and we're liable for hiring that individual. And so we're in kind of a tight spot there. Through the legislature, a year ago, the Utah State Legislature put in some language into a bill that would allow us to have a stable workforce, identify those people that are here, let them pay a fine for coming to the country illegally, and be able to have a 3-year visa, which could be extended if they're not in some sort of trouble with the law. Now, that's being fought, you know, nationally and in the state. If we shut the borders off,
you know, I believe 100% we should have control of the borders of this country. We should know who's coming in. We should be able to take care of that and identify that. But if we have to make a system, we have a system now that would allow people to come in with work visas, but it's so backed up, it's so lethargic, that I'd be waiting 15 years in some cases to get people to come from other countries to work. And if we take away our workforce, we're done, you know.
And that's a key question. We just have about a minute left. Some people say, well, if we did shut the border off, we could find enough workers just domestically for the agricultural operations.
We've actually tried that. If we go to workforce services, 15 people will come out and look at me and say, you want me to do what? You want me to stand on this floor and milk a cow for 8 hours? Or, you know, it just, people don't understand what it takes to run an agriculture facility. And, you know, as far as machinery is dangerous. And if you don't grow up around machinery and you're not used to being on it, it scares me to death to hire someone to come and put on a machine. If you have somebody come out from workforce services, you'll have 17, 18 people come out, and one will come back for the first shift, and it's amazing if they last the whole shift, and nobody will come back the second day.
Well, we're out of time, and the celebration gets underway here. I think you're going to be moderator for...
Unfortunately, I am.
Introducing some key people.
Yeah.
So that'll be interesting for you. You're representing the dairymen and farmers and ranchers of Utah. That'll be a good opportunity for you.
Yeah.
Mark Gibbons from Lewiston, a dairyman in Lewiston area, and president of the Utah Dairymen Association. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Coming up following a brief break, we're going to be talking with Chuck Gay, USU Associate Vice President for Cooperative Extension. There's a coinciding 150th anniversary. That's the signing of the Morrill Act, which established the People's Universities, the land-grant system of public colleges and universities, coming with Chuck Gay following this break.
Good morning, everyone, across Utah this morning. Clear skies and mild temperatures on our way to a very warm day all across the state. Well, big picture-wise, high pressure overhead will give way to an approaching disturbance stage left as the day wears on. Look for an increased chance of convection in northern and central locations tonight and tomorrow as a bit more moisture flutters into the picture. Also expect gusty south winds in the southwest as the afternoon wears on. Temperature-wise, look for daytime readings a bit warmer than yesterday. Afternoon highs will be largely in the 80s statewide. Low 90s for Moab, 10 squared minus 2 for St. George. And anyone interested in the snowpack out there, most locations in the mountains of Utah are sitting at 10% or less of the seasonal norm, some places at 0%. So, warmer today, a chance for showers and thunderstorms this evening and tomorrow in northern and central locations, breezy south winds for Dixie, and just one last thing, folks, if a cat throws up on the porch, you're going to want to go ahead and clean that up. Just another helpful tip from your full-service Utah Climate Center.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We are coming to you from the Federal Building, the Wallace F. Bennett Federal Building, at the plaza outside. And you can hear the traffic going by. We have many people setting up booths. There'll be some celebration activities. The John Deere tractor, an old John Deere tractor out front as well. We're at the celebration, Utah celebration, of the 150th anniversary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. President Lincoln signed that bill into law today, 150 years ago. There's a coinciding anniversary. That's of the Morrill Act, which established the People's Universities, the land-grant system of public colleges and universities, help make higher education accessible to all. Later on, the Cooperative Extension Program. We are pleased to be joined by Chuck Gay, USU Associate Vice President for Cooperative Extension. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
We should say that this program is supported by Utah State University Extension. Our thanks to Extension. So the Morrill Act, this really democratized higher education, didn't it?
It did. It had been in the minds of our founding fathers from the very beginning. In fact, in his inaugural address on the steps of what is now our Wall Street facilities in New York. Washington mentioned this kind of a university, that the dream was that he could see would be a country that could support this kind of a university so that the common man could get a higher education. And of course, it's a very Jeffersonian concept, and Jefferson was one of the great proponents as well of sort of beginning to move the wheels forward. But it really happened with Justin Morrill from Vermont, who never went to college, but had come out of a agricultural background. His small farm and home is memorialized now in Vermont. But it was his concept. And the really interesting thing is that one of the most important pieces of legislation in the history of the country for the not only the development of our country, but the development of the world's agriculture, the training of the agronomists and animal production people all over the world, it all happened as sort of the first GI Bill, if you will, because President Lincoln and Congress knew that the war would end, the Civil War would end at some time, and there had to be some sort of reconstruction, and one of the ways to do that and to begin to grow the economy was to have an educated workforce. So it happened, and here we are today.
So what would higher education have looked like before the Morrill Act?
Private universities primarily. Of course, our great universities like our Ivy League schools, Princeton, Harvard, Yale, all of those schools were in place, but they were private, and it was if you came from a wealthy family, you could achieve a higher education. But when they created the land grants, somewhat like the Department of Agriculture being called the People's Department, the land grant universities became the People's Universities or People's Colleges, as they were at that time.
And this was originally designed to purvey agricultural knowledge, right? Knowledge?
Yeah, agriculture, home economics, and the mechanical arts.
In fact, Utah State University, I think, is Utah State University of Agriculture.
The long form.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And in fact, that's why we still have the A&Ms, a few of them around the agriculture and mechanical arts.
Right. But then it expanded over time to include many other subjects.
That's right. Because you have to, wanting to educate the whole man, so to speak, the liberal arts, the education, of course, engineering was always part of it, the soil sciences, the earth sciences, the biology. It was as all of these sciences began to flourish and grow and new knowledge formed and disciplines developed out of that, you now have the whole array.
Mm. We're familiar with what the GI Bill did in our time. I imagine there was a similar effect with this first GI Bill.
Thinking about this, there were all of these returning soldiers. There were going to be all of these returning soldiers at the end of the war. And one of the things to do was to make higher education available at low cost to try to upgrade the workforce and the capacity of the country, if you will. And it worked. It was a great idea.
We're talking with Chuck Gay, who's a USU Associate Vice President for Cooperative Extension. We're talking about the Morrill Act. USDA was formed on this day, 150 years ago, and in that same year, the Morrill Act was
signed. July 2nd of 1862. Same Congress, same president.
Yeah.
And, of course, then the other legislation like the Railroad Act, the Homestead Act. I mean, these all came together to really move the country forward, And at that time, we were into the great westward expansion, and so the Homestead Act and the Railroad Act were absolutely essential for the development of the West.
Before we take it forward, I'm interested in Justin Moore. You said he never went to college.
No.
But he was interested, I guess, in education.
Absolutely. Well, he knew that he could see in his own life what a difference education made, because it, as a member of Congress, he was sitting with people who, with Harvard degrees and Yale degrees and Princeton degrees and these sorts of things, and he saw what an advantage that provided to his cohorts. And so, yes, he was an extraordinary supporter.
Now, when did the Cooperative Extension come on the scene?
It was created by the Smith-Lever Act in 1914. In Utah, interestingly enough, John Widsoe developed the Extension Division. At that time, he was director of the Agricultural Experiment Station, one of the first directors. And he could see that creating the information by research and developing new knowledge was wonderful, but if it didn't get to the people that needed it, it didn't have the value and impact that it should. And so in 1907, he created the Extension Division and began to go out around the state, horse and wagon often, and by railroad, and meet with agricultural producers and other people and provide information. And so we are actually 100 years old, and more than 100 years old in Utah.
So this preceded the national
cooperative.
Yes, it did. Far-reaching. And I believe we've talked about Johnny Widsoe before, you and I.
Yes.
Interesting biography. I had several interviews about him. One of his textbooks still used today.
Yes. In fact, it's for, if you go on Amazon.com, you can still buy it from a number of publishers. All of his books on dryland agriculture and farming and irrigation, and still translated into many different languages and utilized around the world.
So the extension program, still the mission is take that knowledge out to the people.
That's it. It's to provide research-based information, credible information to the public that needs it.
A lot of us connect with the extension through gardening. But it's farmers and a lot of types of information. Let's bring in, at this point, Dave Conine, who's Utah Director of Rural Development. Tell us what Rural Development. We'll have to talk loud. We're out here on the plaza. What does your agency do? What does Rural Development do?
Well, USDA Rural Development has a variety of programs that invest in rural communities. We have a housing program. We have a business and industry loan guarantee program. We finance through grants and loans community facilities, water and environmental programs, and that's pretty much it. In Utah, we did $405 million in FY11. For housing programs. Included in that was the financing of 2,245 single-family homes, mostly through loan guarantees. So we provide a guarantee to the bank that the borrower will follow through and pay the loan. According to the National Association of Realtors, every single home sold generates $58,000 of local economic activity. So our 2,200-plus homes is about $130 million of economic activity in rural Utah as just a spinoff from those housing sales. Business and industry program invested $17.3 million in loan guarantees for rural business in Utah, pretty well spread out through the state. That's been for business startups, business expansion. It's done a great deal to both save existing jobs and create new ones. Additionally, we have a Rural Energy for America program, or REAP, using government acronyms, that's invested $2.16 million in renewable energy, mostly related to agriculture and on-farm energy production and conservation. We've had a distant learning and telemedicine project that has put in $1.75 million FY11 to improve telemedicine for remote locations, and also hook up the schools into the Utah Education Network. So the community programs have invested in everything from police, fire stations, ambulances, fire equipment, all the whole variety of public safety equipment, libraries, water, wastewater. So there's a tremendous variety of improvements that go into the rural communities through those programs, all of which, housing, community facilities, and business, all focus on improving the quality of life and the economy in rural Utah.
We're just about out of time. I was going to ask you, Chuck Gay, these are issues that I'm sure you're familiar with in the cooperative extension, the housing, the jobs, the medical services to the rural areas.
They are, and with Dave sitting here next to me, we work together all the time. We're in constant communication. We sit on development activities together. We've organized conferences to promote different things. Extension has a federal partner, and we are sort of joined at the hip with USDA in just about everything we do. And so for the 150 years, USDA and the land grants have been great partners in all facets.
And this is 150 years for both.
It is.
And this is the very day of the signing into existence of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We're at the Utah Celebration here, and we've been talking with various people. We thank Dave Conine, State Director for Rural Development. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
For coming in. Chuck Gay, who's Associate Vice President for Cooperative Extension at Utah State University. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Talking about the Morrill Act and land-grant institutions. And I believe you'll be involved in some ceremonies later on as well.
That's our understanding as well.
And that'll be happening later today. We're on the plaza outside the federal building in downtown Salt Lake City. This broadcast has been made possible by Utah State University Extension. And just a note about tomorrow, Eric Greitens, who's an author, former Navy SEAL, and humanitarian. We'll talk about the Navy SEAL program, humanitarian action. We'll talk about Afghanistan as well. Very interesting. He's written a book about his experiences. That's the program for tomorrow. And for Access Utah today, I'm Tom Williams, again coming to you from the Plaza Federal Building in downtown Salt Lake City. Thanks so much for listening.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.